power of love, this is what Jimi Hendrix wrote. He said, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. And Albert Schweitzer said, by having reverence for life, we enter into a spiritual relation with the world. Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and you can listen to us live on the internet at cooperadio.org. Animal Voices is presented to you by volunteer members of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, EarthSafe Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society, three great organizations dedicated to the well-being of our kindred species, the animals. We invite you to visit our webpage. Alan Jensen is the control room. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today we have co-hosts Marge Adams and John Pranger. John Pranger, you have a quote for us today.
Yeah, another very famous musician, of course, Paul McCartney, said if slaughterhouses had were made of glass, we'd all be vegetarians.
Yes, he said that. And we have a great program for today. Within a few minutes, less than a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Barbara Murray, who is the director of Bear Matters BC. And we'll be hearing the latest about Boo the grizzly bear. At about 20 past the hour, Peter Fricker from the Vancouver Humane Society will give us an update about exotic animals. And after that, we will contact Dr. Vince Lurie, naturopathic doctor in Vancouver, who came from South Africa, and we will hear wildlife stories from Africa, and maybe how he got caught in a herd of buffalo. In the second hour of Animal Voices, we will be playing a program from Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, BC. The program is called Deconstructing Dinner, and John Steinman will tell us about shocking sugar. Well, on the line from North Vancouver, a great advocate for the bears and the director of Bear Matters, we have Barbara Murray. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, Carl.
Yes, and you know, it's a most engaging story about Boo the grizzly bear and what's happened to him over the past 3 or 4 years. And maybe you can tell us something about how you feel and what happened to this grizzly bear.
Yes, well, I was first introduced to Boo and his brother back in 2003 up on Grouse Mountain, just shortly after, very shortly after, his mother was in the late spring hunt, okay, the grizzly bear hunt. So she was killed. She was a resident bear up near Wells, near Quesnel, and a local person finally got his tag, his grizzly bear tag. And I guess he was overexcited about it because he might never get another tag for a grizzly bear. They just give out about 300, and most of those are won through lotteries. So he, unfortunately,
how much do they cost?
Pardon me?
How much does it cost to shoot a grizzly bear?
That's a very good question, Carl. You know, I think it's like $100 or $200. I'm not sure. I know that for a black bear tag, which they sell, you know, over about 5,000 of them a year, they're about $20 for one bear.
Jeez.
And you can get two tags. But grizzly bears is quite a bit more, but still not inordinately so. And obviously the outfitters get so many tags allotted across that 300 number, and they charge thousands for the out of province or out of country hunter. So I think that's how Boo and Carrie's mother was shot by a local hunter, just really excited about having this tag. June 15th is the deadline for the spring bear hunt. It was probably just before that, I believe. And he just went and took his chances and shot this sleeping bear that had the cubs not very far away from her. So it was very, very sad. So he was fined $9,000 after about a year in the courts, and I'm sure he'll never do that again, but he does have his trophy. So there we have Carrie and Boo. And now Carrie and Boo were transferred to Kicking Horse in 2003, at the end of 2003, to start the zoo at Kicking Horse officially. So they had two grizzlies on Grouse and two at the sister resort of Kicking Horse. So that went along for a year. And then in 2004, Carrie didn't wake up from the den. They opened the den. He had a twisted intestine over the hibernation period, and they were locking the dens at that point, which I don't believe they are now, but Boo did arise. So he'd been through a lot already at that point back in 2004, in April 2004. And here we are in 2006, and he's been through a heck of a lot more. So,
so now he watches his mother being shot by this hunter.
Yes, at about 4 months
and,
old.
And then he is at this. He watches his companion mm-hmm. dying in a locked up
Definitely.
Cage, mm-hmm. which should never have been locked up during. We know now that these bears should be, that they move around during hibernation.
Yeah, they're not true hibernators, black and grizzly, any bear. They're not, they do move around, they stretch, they sometimes go for a walk outside the den site. You know, that's very typical.
So now, what happens to Boo then? He never was at Grouse Mountain, was he?
He was at Grouse Mountain. They didn't show Carrie and Boo very long out with the other... had two other bears earlier that they've kept up there now. And so they transferred them over. I think they were just a year old. They took them over to Carrie's horse. So they really, initially when they brought them in, we thought they were going to rehabilitate them and release them back into the wild at such a young age when they were first rescued. That's very much a possibility. They do it in Russia and Romania, and it's been done once before with two cubs up in Dawson Creek. So we all thought, we were very hopeful that they would get their second chance at being wild, but it didn't happen. They were transferred to Kicking Horse, and that's where they remain. And now Boo on his own has had some other ideas to gain his freedom, and that's when the headlines hit around the world that he had dug himself underneath his electric fence and went off to romp in mating season with whatever female was willing.
Now, the interesting thing is that you mentioned previously that the bears who are not raised by their mothers, they mature much earlier.
Yes. The
rehabbers. Isn't that interesting, a survival tactic here?
Yeah, the rehabbers have studied this to a great extent, rehabbers especially of black bears, which give us lots of clues and help for the grizzly bears. They've watched these grizzly bears they've watched these grizzly bears mature really quickly in captivity, so, because they're so much more independent than their you know, favored and mothered counterparts. So that at 4 years old, they might be more like a 6 year old out in the wild. Mm-hmm. So that's really encouraging. I mean, that gives them much more intelligence, I suppose, much more ability to deal with their wild counterparts. They're stronger medically. They're more, pristine because they've been cared for by their caregivers. So they don't have, any ticks and mites and parasites that the wild counterparts would have.
And when they come out of the refuge, they're usually a little bit heavier too, is it?
Yes, yeah, they definitely are very well fed, and they have very little exercise. So that's what the authorities worry about with especially rehab bears, that they'll be too heavy. But they equalize their weight very, very quickly. And that's been proven again as they've watched black bears out in the wild. And, they've monitored the rehab black bears. So they know that the grizzly bears will respond very similarly. So within a month, Boo lost a lot of weight, and he was brought more to the size of his, again, wild counterparts at about that age. He was still, again, probably a year or two ahead of them in maturity level, because of his experiences.
Now, Boo escaped a number of times from the refuge in Kicking Horse Mountain Resort. Is that correct?
Well, Carl, that's the interesting thing. Now, Boo was conditioned to electric fences, both at Grouse Mountain and at Kicking Horse. So he, from a very early age, he was told not to go near electric fences. It hurt, it gave him a shock. So he wasn't going to try that, and he didn't try it. He actually dug underneath the first time, remember? So the second escape, we're not sure it was Boo, because they had not radio-collared Boo initially. They had microchipped him, but not radio-collared him. So there's some of us that are suspect that they had actually captured a wild bear that second time, because he just smashed through the metal door he was behind. He smashed through the electric fences, which tells us that that bear might not have been conditioned to electric fences. He just put his head down and went through them, and it might have given him a start, but it didn't kill him. And he's probably a long way away from that enclosure.
It shows a determination of this grizzly bear Boo to have freedom and certainly the mating instinct.
And we just can't assume anything about these bears. We can't assume that they're not rehabilitatable. We can't assume that they're enjoying their captive lives. We can't assume that, you know, we can neuter them and change all their behavior patterns, because it's thousands of years of instinct that we have behind them.
Now, maybe we can just say something about their natural movement, how they move around, because, you know, it made headlines that Boo the bear, the grizzly, went back to the refuge. So there's a way of explaining that.
Yes. I thought, okay, well, Boo's kind of, he's told us he wanted his freedom, and now he's told us he wants back to be looked after again now that the mating season's over. But I contacted Dr. John Beecham down in Idaho, who's the foremost international bear rehabilitator, grizzly and black, and he suggested this idea, that Boo is just going back to a known food source. He'd been mating, but he'd obviously survived quite nicely for over 30 days in the wild on his own, eating berries and roots and shoots and maybe following other bear scents around and getting the natural resources there. And then when they became a little sparse, or maybe there was competition from other bears, he thought, I remember a food source that was quite readily available, so I think I'll just now mosey back over to that food source. So he wandered back in. But he definitely, if that had run out or been changed or moved to another position, he might have followed that and gone back into the wild yet again. And I mean, he could be, you know, he could have tried to be rehabilitated if the authorities were so, willing.
Now, Smart Bear, he says, well, I've broken free twice. And the urge to go and have some food at the refuge was stronger, and the idea was, well, if he's done it twice, he can break through the electric fence a third time. But then came the whole idea that people were saying this bear should be neutered.
Yeah, that was their first response at Kicking Horse, and this is where we're not happy with ski resorts, you know, and I'm working with quite a few other animal welfare groups on this. We don't think ski resorts are the place to raise grizzly bears, either for captive entertainment purposes or for rehab and release. They don't have the research and scientific background to do this, and they'd have to really heavily consult with people that have already done it. And I don't think they have the time or the inclination to do that. Their motivation is profit, which is fine. I mean, we need viable businesses out there. But we can't fool ourselves that they're going to take the time and patience that it might take to do things in a really scientific manner. So, you know, that neutering was an idea that came up with. It hit the headlines. And I know the Minister of the Environment has made them back off on that one, because it would be so unpopular with the tourists that come to visit, and it just seems like a very unfair treatment for a bear that really hasn't done anything wrong.
Now, we only got a few minutes left, but what I'd like to cover also is that there are these bears in captivity, and everybody's looking at them, and they're becoming like theirs that are habituated to the garbage cans. They get used to humans, but the amazing thing is that these bears, when they have been in captivity, show no aggressiveness towards humans.
That's right. I mean, I believe Kicking Horse, if you go on their website, has a clip of Boo bluff charging the electric fence when there's tourists on the other side. So that is a sign of stress. I think in all zoos they have to watch for that, pacing up and down, and also bluff charging, snorting, you know, making noises to just stay back, you're in my space kind of thing. So that's telling us that, you know, it's a very stressful situation. Black bears tend to adapt better to captivity because they're more socially inclined than grizzly bears. Grizzlies are very, very private animals. They're very shy. And grizzly bears are really, not interested in humans. And I think it's 76% of all grizzly attacks actually happen by females.
Barbara, in closing here, I wonder if you could just summarize what lessons are there to be learned from this escapades of Boo the grizzly bear?
Well, first off, I think, you know, we're really blessed in BC to even have grizzly bears in the wild. So my thrust here is we really have to promote saving any grizzly bear cub we find, orphan grizzly bear cub. We have to be able to take them to a rehab shelter, away from people, away from tourists, away from volunteers, and let them be given that second chance to be wild by one of our, we have two amazing women up north that are ready and able to do grizzly bears as well as they've been doing black bears for years. But, you know, don't give any more zoo licenses out. Don't expand the programs at Grouser or Kicking Horse especially. Boo has to be comfortable now. I don't know if I don't think there's any chance of him being rehabbed unless somebody comes up with a lot of money. But the next young cubs that come along, please don't send them to a commercial enterprise. Let's keep BC wild. Let's show our visit what we truly have to offer in the wild, not behind electric.
Now, thank you, Barbara Murray, for being on Animal Voices. Very interesting story. And you're with Bear Matters BC. I think you're the founder of that.
Yes.
And do you have a web page?
Yes, it's www.bearmatters.com.
That's good and easy to remember, and a wonderful resource. Thank you, Barbara Murray.
Thank you, girl.
And you're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And over to Marge.
Thank you, Carl. We have Peter Fricker, who is the project coordinator for the Vancouver Humane Society, on the line right now. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Marge.
Nice to have you back.
Thanks very much.
You have been working for quite some time on exotic animal issues, and I know a couple of, quite interesting incidents have occurred very recently in our local area, one in Surrey and one in Kitsilano. I wonder if you would tell us about what has happened.
Yes, that's right, Marge, and I think we've had a few incidents now that really show that the trend towards the ownership of exotic animals is getting out of hand and show why we need bylaws. Last week, it was reported that in Surrey, a rattlesnake was found in a vacated apartment. The landlord went in and found a 10-year-old rattlesnake and called the Reptile Refuge in Surrey. They rescued the animal where it took it to the refuge where it's now receiving care. And of course, a few weeks ago in late June, we had an incident in Kitsilano where a 5-foot-long caiman, which is a crocodile-like animal, fell from the third-floor window of an apartment and was injured. And it turned out that the gentleman who owned this caiman also had a whole menagerie of about 30 to 40 other reptiles. People were shocked that their neighbor had these kinds of animals.
And this was legal, was it?
In Vancouver, certainly there is no bylaw. It's perfectly legal to keep anything from a lion or a tiger to an alligator in your basement. And that's why we've been working very hard with the council to convince them to put a bylaw in place.
I wonder how the rest of the people living in an apartment building with 30 or 40 reptiles would feel about that, and would they not be inclined to move out?
Well, I think certainly the evidence we had was that people were uncomfortable with this, but of course, I mean, for a number of reasons. One is, of course, something like the caiman, the size of the caiman and so on. People are concerned for their safety, but a lot of people, and this is, of course, the VHS's position, feel that it's inhumane to keep animals like this in captivity, in tanks in your basement, or in a small apartment in Kitsilano. These animals, they're captive bred, or whether they're wild caught, they retain the same behavioral and biological needs as wild animals, and we think they belong in their natural habitat, and that people should stop buying them and putting them in small tanks and
well, it's something like a 5-foot-long caiman, which is a crocodile, would be somebody visiting that apartment could get well killed, couldn't he?
Certainly, they could get a very nasty bite. And we felt that certainly when this animal fell from the window and was on the ground, that if a small child had come upon the animal, which is obviously stressed and injured and therefore more likely to be dangerous, it could have been a much more serious incident than it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now the other incident was this snake. Now, that's a rattler, which is a native species. So that has other implications, doesn't it?
Well, that is illegal to keep native animals, native wildlife in B.C. Anyone who's keeping native wildlife needs to have a permit from the Ministry of the Environment. But obviously the people who were living there were extremely irresponsible. First of all, they were breaking the law. Secondly, they didn't care about the animal. They just left it there. It was dehydrated. It wasn't left any food. And they didn't care about any people who came upon it after they left and who might have been bitten and in this case, killed.
I understand our friends at the Rainforest Reptile Refuge got in on the rescue operation.
That's right. That's one of the few places, perhaps in the Lower Mainland, the only place where a confiscated reptile can be taken. And, of course, they've got over 400 animals already there and not a lot of space. And, it just ends up as a dumping ground to deal with the irresponsibility of people who take on these animals, realize that they can't care for them, and then simply abandon them. It's a good thing that they're there, but unfortunately it means that people never have to face up to the responsibility of what they've done.
I wonder about that. Wouldn't they be charged, the person responsible, be charged by the authorities?
We would hope so in the case of the rattlesnake, but for all other exotic animals, and most of these animals are, these exotic pets are from either captive breeders or from capture in the wild, they would not be covered, at least not in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I know you have been working with the City of Vancouver or are trying to influence the City of Vancouver Council about legislation. Now, what type of legislation are you hoping to get through eventually?
Well, with all the municipalities that we work with, what we recommend is a bylaw that ends both the sale and ownership of exotic animals. In some municipalities, such as Surrey and Richmond, they've only gone as far as banning the sale of these animals. And to us, that's totally impractical. It's virtually useless because today people can acquire almost anything, almost any exotic animal, over the Internet and in classified advertising. It doesn't necessarily need to come from a pet shop in the municipality. So there's no way of stopping people from getting these animals if a bylaw just bans the sale. And, of course, they can go into a neighboring municipality where there is no bylaw.
But it could be, keeping could be outlawed as well, couldn't it?
And that's what we're looking for, is a bylaw that bans both the ownership and the sale. So basically, people just could not have these things. Mm-hmm. What would likely happen is that there would be a grandfather clause in the bylaw, which would mean that people who currently have these animals wouldn't have to suddenly get rid of them. I mean, that would be, in our view, that would be impractical because there would be hundreds, probably thousands of these animals, and we couldn't just see the city or the SPCA or someone confiscate them because at the moment there's just nowhere to put a large number of those animals very quickly.
Yeah. So where does your effort with the city council rest right now?
Well, we're really pleased because the council is currently studying the case for a bylaw. They are taking information from stakeholders, ourselves, the SPCA, that kind of group. And later on, I think towards September, they will be doing more public consultation. And then the council will be looking at a report from the city staff in the fall. And we're hoping at that point that they will debate it. And of course, we're hoping they'll approve a bylaw that will ban these animals.
And is there any point in letter writing right now? Would you say, or
certainly,
it
would be
involved?
Very helpful for people who care about animals to make their views known to the city.
Because there are such wide implications, aren't there, for exotic species right, killed by the hundreds in order to get one into our city, for example. There are very wide implications.
That's true. We know that the whole global pet trade involves the shipments of millions of animals around the world. Often decimating the populations in their natural habitat, many die in transport, and then more die while kept in captivity, basically being, you know, warehoused here into to pet shops or into people's living rooms, where more will die or suffer if they're not properly cared for. So yes, it's not only a local issue; it's a global issue as well.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for this, Peter. Appreciate having you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Marge.
Yes, and you, once again, you're listening to Animal Voices, and we have a very special treat within 10 minutes' time. We'll be speaking with Dr. Vince Lurie. And if you'd like to have a look at his webpage in the meantime, it's www.lurie.com. And we're going to talk about stories from Africa. He's been in the Kalahari and all kinds of places. But one of the local events that are happening tomorrow is from the Small Animal Rescue Society of British Columbia. And this is called Bottles for Bunny, for Bunnies. And so tomorrow between 10 a.m., tomorrow Saturday, between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., you're asked to bring empty out your apartment and living quarters from bottles that are standing around and donate it for the Bottles for Bunnies project, which can be delivered to the K&J Bottle Depot, 1856 Powell Street. And if you need any more information, you can contact by email smallanimalrescue.org or phone this number, 604-439-9165. Donate your empty bottles to the K&J Bottle Depot in East Vancouver. So Bottles for Bunnies. And we're going to go over to John. John Pranger is a board member of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. And over to John.
Thank you, Carl. July the 8th, we had the 10K run or 5K walk to uncover cures for cancers below the waist. And it was the underwear affair, and it collected money for the BC Cancer Foundation. I'm afraid that much of that money is going to be wasted on animal experimentation, but there is something that you can do to avoid these cancers. A cure is very, very unlikely. We've been looking for a cure for 100 years and more, and they just don't appear. Cancer has to be prevented. It can't really be cured. It can be managed and cut out and various things, but it can't be cured. What needs to be cured is lifestyle. Just one hamburger could kill you. That's the finding of the largest study to date on the link between meat consumption and colon cancer. According to the study's authors, men who ate 3 ounces of meat a day and women who ate just 2 ounces a day increased their risk of developing colon cancer by 30%. Now, one serving of meat is approximately the size of a deck of cards, which is far less than most Americans eat in one sitting, let alone in one day. Now, when a sliver of meat is enough to contribute to one of America's biggest killers, colon cancer, is the second largest cause of cancer deaths in Canada, it's probably time to reconsider the meaning of the word moderation. Now, what is it about meat that contributes to colon cancer? Well, it probably has something to do with the human anatomy. Unlike true carnivores, such as lions and tigers, who have short, straight intestines, humans have long, twisting digestive tracts, very much like those of our vegetarian cousins, orangutans and gorillas. This long and winding road is perfect for breaking down fibrous fruits and vegetables, but it's not so good at rapidly ejecting meat, which instead hangs around and fosters the production of cancer-causing chemicals. Just about any meat is loaded with the saturated fat that even the American Cancer Society is linked to cancers of the colon and the rectum. Preserved meats, such as cured ham and hot dogs, bacon, pepperoni, bologna, salami, those are major culprits in colorectal cancer. According to initial results from the landmark European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition, short form is EPIC, that's European Prospective, meaning looked at into the future through tendencies of the past. Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition, which involves more than 500,000 people in 10 countries, those who consume preserved meats were found to have a 50% greater chance of developing colorectal cancer than those who ate no preserved meats. So it's now easier than ever to go meatless with veggie burgers and not dogs and faux chicken nuggets and other vegetarian convenience food cropping up in the supermarket freezer case by the day. So these products make it easy to replace the ground beef in your family's favorite recipe with veggie burger crumbles or to tide the kids over until dinner with faux ham deli slices. And to ward off colon cancer, dump meat from your diet. You'll also be protecting yourself against other cancers, of course, heart disease, diabetes, and stroke.
Yes, John, I see that was an article by Dr. Neil Bonner, mm-hmm. and he's the founder of an organization which has some 5,000 physicians as members, and they're called Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And thanks for mentioning that, also we often say here on this program that the primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants. And something wonderful you can do for yourself and all life on Earth, and it is an environmental issue, is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products. And you're a living testimony of good health and enjoyment of life. And you're a vegetarian.
That's right. And, you know, becoming a vegetarian is the most liberating thing that you can do for yourself, because suddenly your destiny is in your own hands, and it can be determined by what you eat, because what you eat today walks and talks tomorrow.
Right. I'm going to give a little plug here for Bottles for Bunnies, because, you know, there's so many bunny rabbits that get abandoned. That's tomorrow, Saturday, July the 22nd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the K&J Bottle Depot on 1856 Powell Street. Bring your bottles and support the Rabbit Rescue Association, the Small Animal Rescue Association.
Is this dealing with the bunnies in Richmond that have been
abandoned? No, it's not dealing with them. Many people abandon their rabbits, but we're going to have somebody on our program shortly to explain how this issue happens, because now there's a sort of literally a bounty on rabbits because it's interfering with the agricultural crops, and that should never happen because these animals are breeding and they're they don't survive well in the wild, especially if they've been in cages for so long. Well, I'm going to go over to Alan Jensen, and do you have a spot of music for us? Over to Alan Jensen. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on your favorite radio station with great variety, Co-op Radio. Our webpage is coopradio.org, and we have a very special, our own webpage where many of our past programs can be listened to. So that is animalvoices.org. Well, I promised you that today you're going to have a very special guest. And it is Dr. Vince Lurie, L-U-R-I-E. He is a naturopathic physician in Vancouver, and he came from South Africa. And we hope to hear some wildlife stories from his homeland. Welcome to Animal Voices, Dr. Vince Lurie.
Oh, hi, Carl.
Yes, so you spent many years, and you raised your daughters in South Africa, and you taught them much about wildlife by going out to the parks, and you had many and varied experiences there. And maybe people love stories, so maybe you can just tell us some of the ones that fascinated you.
Yes, certainly I could, Carl. In fact, we were extremely fortunate in having a whole variety of nature reserves within a day's drive of our home. So we usually used to go into these reserves to recharge the batteries, as a and one story that comes to mind is we were in the Pielensberg, which is in Botswana near the city, and we were doing a walking trail there, and they Pielensberg is situated inside an extinct crater, and they were reintroducing all the original wildlife there. Well, while on this walking trail, we saw a black rhino, which was highly endangered and had recently been reintroduced. So our ranger said he needed to get closer to this rhino in order to have a good look, get its identification, because of course they were tracking the movement. So he set out walking after the rhino, and he handed his gun to one of us, and he said, "You hang out there behind me, and I'm just going to get close to it, and I'm going to have a good look." And sure enough, he started getting closer and closer, and when he was out 20 meters away, the rhino suddenly sniffed the air and immediately started walking towards the ranger. So the ranger, realizing that you know, you don't run from a rhino, they have weak eyesight, so the best thing is really to keep still. So he decided to climb into a tree. However, the problem was we were in open grassland, and the only trees were a few little thorny acacia bushes scattered around. So here he was having to hop into this tree. It was about 8 foot tall. It had it looked like a Y shape. The trunk came out of the ground, then it forked into two, and he jumped into the middle of the fork and was holding on to each side. And the rhino approached him, and eventually it was standing right in front of him, smelling his shoe, and he said he could feel the hot breath. And all of a sudden we heard a crack, and the tree started splitting longitudinally down the middle.
Right.
And he was hanging on to both halves, trying to hold it together. The rhino was sniffing his shoe, and we were all just standing there sort of praying for him. And eventually the rhino just... I guess it got bored, and it started walking away. But that was one of the experiences we had.
Good thing the black rhino is vegetarian.
That's correct. There are two kinds, main kinds of rhino. The black rhino and the white rhino are the common names. And they're not black and white. They look the same color. They both, whatever color the mud was that they happened to roll in that day.
Right.
So they're sort of gray. But... the white rhino, they think the word white really came from its wide mouth, wide, white, you know. And its mouth was flat and wide, used for eating grass. So it was a grazer, but the black rhino had a hooked lip for grabbing branches because it's a browser. Hmm. So.
And now the rhino has the horn, which is, yes, of course contributes towards its being an endangered species.
Yes.
But that was for protection, or also making holes in the ground?
Yes, exactly. It's used for a lot of things. And these horns are enormous, Carl. I mean, they've seen a white rhino with a horn about nearly 6 foot long. So
right.
If you think about this, this is a horn on the tip of its... upper jaw, you might say, and then it's got a shorter horn a little bit back. The white rhinos grow up to about 4,000 pounds in weight. The black rhinos about 2,500 pounds.
Now, when you of course lived in Johannesburg, and so what is the state of the national parks there in the New South Africa?
You know, I believe they still good, Carl. I haven't been back for about 30 years. But I hear they're still pretty good. And I think the enormous herds of game that one can see attest to this.
Right. Now, some years ago I was in the Gorogoro crater, and there was a story happening to that everybody was talking about was this black, it was a rhino, and its baby, the baby got stuck in the mud. And
yeah.
Of course, the mother stayed with the baby rhino, and she could do nothing. The baby was just sinking deeper into mud and had been there for days. An elephant came by, and even though the rhino attacked the elephant went ahead, put its trunk under baby rhino, lifted it out of the mud. And isn't that a moving story?
That is truly amazing. And I guess the elephants have a lot of experience in this because they continually rescuing their calves.
Right. Yeah, well, with the poor eyesight, they'll just walk straight into the mud.
Yeah.
But especially in rainy season. Now, you've had many good experiences, and I think as a naturopathic physician, Vancouver is very blessed to have your services here. But you also got involved with a herd of buffalo. There's a story there.
Yeah, that was in the Kruger National Park.
That's one of the biggest game parks in Africa, is it?
Yes, it's one of the largest ones in southern Africa. I mean, nowhere near the size of Serengeti, but it's still pretty large. It's a good few hundred miles long by about 50 to 60 miles wide. So it's big enough to have these large herds of animals. And we were at a camp called Losabi, which is one of my favorite spots. And we were out driving one day, and we decided to go off the main road onto a small sand road, and ahead of us we could see that there were some buffalo crossing. So we stopped to allow them to cross, which is what you do when you're driving in a game. And I'm talking about the Cape buffalo here. The Cape buffalo is really like the big cousin of the American buffalo. You know, Cape buffalo can also get up to about 2,000 pounds, just
wow.
Like the black rhino.
What horns?
They've got enormous horns.
Foot
across.
Circular, isn't it?
Yes, they go down and then sweep up again. And they have an enormous boss, a thickening of the horn on the base of the head, which makes them makes them extremely difficult to hunt from a hunter's perspective. And they also have a reputation of being the most dangerous animal in Africa, and they are reputed to have caused more deaths amongst the local populations than any other animal, because they seem to be vindictive. If they get hunted and they get away, they will circle round and hunt the hunter.
Wow.
Yeah. And
Good for them.
One has a healthy respect for the Cape buffalo. And we were watching them cross, and instead of the small herd crossing, more and more came, and eventually the road ahead was just full of buffalo, and I looked in the rear view mirror, and they'd already crossed behind my car, and I was in this enormous herd, and they stretched as far as we could see. I mean, it was really something phenomenal, and this herd never stopped coming. They were walking across the road, and as they crossed, the next ones took their place. This went on for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and we thought, you know, we're never going to get out of here. And in the Kruger Park, they have a curfew. You have to be back in your camp at a certain time. And it was long past our curfew, and we couldn't move. And, eventually, about 4 hours later, we managed to get the herd passed on, and we managed to get back into the camp. And the game warden, very fortunately, did not fine us for breaking the curfew. And he told us they had three herds down there of buffalo, and we must have been in one of them. And these numbered 18,000 in one herd, 15,000 in another herd,
wow.
And 12,000 in the third herd. So, I mean, this says a lot for conservation in southern Africa.
Now, the best time to go to these parks in Africa is, of course, I think at this time of the year, because when it gets too hot there, like in December in the southern hemisphere, the it's too they hide in the shade. You don't see them.
That's quite correct, and of course, with the rain in the summer, the grass is a lot higher. So they could be right next to the road and you might not see them because they could be in tall grass. However, there's another aspect why winter's the best time. And of course, that's the southern hemisphere, so the winters are opposite to ours. And one's talking about May, June, July being a really good time to visit the parks because they have these water holes. And because there's no rain in the winter, what actually happens is the animals all congregate around the water holes, so you've got a much better chance of seeing a lot of activity, a lot of kills, and massed herds at the water holes. And of course, the grass is a lot shorter.
Now, when you go out there, you're dressed appropriately, and presumably you won't be wearing leather shoes like some English person did.
Well, that's another story. We were on a walking safari in a park called Shluwi and
Umkhonzi
in Natal.
I know it.
And we had one of our party was a visitor from England, and he was not appropriately dressed. He was wearing leather-soled shoes. And that's not the ideal sort of footwear to be going on a walking safari. We recommended he change his shoes. He said these were the only ones he had. So we went along this on this walk, and we were walking alongside a river, and we saw quite a nice rhino with a calf on the opposite side of the river. And the rivers are fairly wide there, so our ranger suggested that we cross the river by sort of walking across the rocks. There were some pretty large rocky outcrops, and you could hop from one to the other. So we set about doing this, but this made it even more difficult for this gentleman to sort of keep good footing, especially when hopping from rock to rock. And the inevitable happened. He slipped while he was jumping, and he fell into the water. And we heard the splash, and we looked around, and there he was sort of hanging onto a rock, and we all yanked him out. And as we were doing this, we heard another splash, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw the most enormous crocodile diving into the water. And this was only a few yards away from where he'd fallen in. And
wow.
We didn't even see that croc because it's blended in so well with the rocks. It was at least 12 foot long. And, I mean, if we hadn't got him out so quickly, he would have been dinner.
Yeah. In Malawi, where they have, in Lake Malawi, they have crocodiles there.
Yeah.
And I often went swimming in Lake Malawi, and they said, the crocodiles don't eat white people.
Oh!
Yeah, I've never heard that one. And I've never seen crocs in Lake Malawi, but I have swum in Lake Malawi, and I've seen hippo there, a lot of hippo.
Right.
And of course, they're the big danger, because if you inadvertently walk between a hippo and its calf, mm-hmm. then it will attack you. And hippos are big. They're bigger than rhino even.
Now, people always think people get eaten by lions and stuff, but that's not really so. It's the hippos apparently one of the cause the greatest number of mortalities for humans. You're also mentioning buffalo, of course.
Yes, I've heard of buffalo attacking hunters.
Right.
I think just casual people swimming in the lake could be attacked by hippo. But you probably wouldn't swim if there were hippo around. I mean,
right.
Everything's common sense, you know.
Right. Now, the other thing about, you know, you've traveled all around Africa, southern Africa in particular, and you also quite familiar with the wonderful tribe called the Bushmen.
Yes.
The Bushmen.
Yes.
And of course they're in Botswana.
Correct. In the Kalahari.
Kalahari.
Yeah. And yeah, I went on one safari in Kalahari, and we had a doctor with us in the party. I was not a doctor at the time, and he joined us, and we were camped in the middle of a salt pan. And this is desert, pretty much. And when we woke up morning, there were a whole band of bushmen in our camp. And they'd heard about there being a doctor, so they'd brought along the people who needed medical help to see if our doctor could help them. Now, the bushmen are a really small race of people who reach about 5 feet tall, have slightly yellowish skin, and they have the most amazingly highly developed senses of sight and hearing and smell, and they truly adapt to live out in the wild. And I had a case where, well, after we'd helped them out and they'd spent a few days with us, they asked us if they could help us with anything, and we said yes, we're trying to see some Hem's book, or the oryx, which is a very beautiful antelope, and we hadn't been able to see one. So we asked the bushmen if they could help us find the oryx, and one of them said, no problem, he'll find them for us. So we all got into the Land Rover, and he said, well, we said, hop in. He said, no, he preferred to run in front of the Land Rover. So we took off into the bush. This guy was running along. We were doing about 10, 15 kilometers an hour, and he was running in front of the Land Rover, and he was tracking on the ground as he ran.
Amazing.
And by hand signals, he was, you know, showing us which way to go. And then eventually he held up his hand to tell us to stop, and he said, if you get out now, and this is, of course, through an interpreter, because they speak an extremely strange language with a lot of clicks. The interpreter told us that if we got out at this point and went over the next rise about 100 yards in front of us, we would be able to see two bulls and one cow oryx. And he determined this all from the freshness of the track. And while he was on the run, and we'd gone already about 10 kilometers. So this just shows you how amazingly fit and adaptable these are.
I was going to ask, was he out of breath?
No, not at all.
You know, Dr. Lurie, we've run out of time and yes. Fascinated with all your stories. I just wanted to tell people that you're a naturopathic doctor in Vancouver, and you have a webpage which is www.luriehealth.com, and spelled Lurie, L-U-R-I-E, health.com. And we have you on our program again, and thank you for the wonderful stories.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure, Carl, and you certainly won't find stories on my website. But it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Vince. Yes. And you're listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio, and we'll close off with the quote from Jimi Hendrix, where he said, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. And in the very closing, our beloved Albert Schweitzer said, by having reverence for life, we enter into a spiritual relationship with the world.